Sergeant Detritus's approach to these matters was almost instinctively correct. He had the palace staff lined up in front of him and was shouting at them at the top of his voice.
"Look at old Detritus," Vimes thought as he went down the stairs. "Just your basic thick troll a few years ago, now a valuable member of the Watch, provided you get him to repeat his orders back to you to make sure he understands you. His armour gleams even brighter than carrots because he doesn't get bored with polishing. And he's mastered policing as it is practiced by the majority of forces in the universe, which is basically screaming angrily at people until they give in. The only reason that he's not a one-troll reign of terror is the ease with which his thought processes can be derailed by anyone who tries something fiendishly cunning like an outright denial.
"I know you all done it," he was shouting. "If the person what done it does not own up, the whole staff, and I mean this, the whole staff will be locked up in the tanty, also we throws the key away."
He pointed a finger at a stout scullery maid.
"It was you what done it, own up."
"No."
Detritus paused. Then,
"Where was you last night? Own up."
"In bed, of course."
"Aha! That's a likely story. Own up. That where you always is at night?"
"Of course."
"Ha ha ha! Own up. You got witnesses? Sauce. Ah, so you got no witnesses. You done it then. Own up."
"No."
"Oh. All right, thank you, Sergeant. That will be all for now," said Vimes, patting him on the shoulder. "Are all the staff here?" He glared at the lineup. "Well, are you all here?" There was a certain amount of reluctant shuffling among the ranks, and then someone cautiously put up a hand.
"Mildred Easy hasn't been seen since yesterday," said its owner. "She's the upstairs maid. A boy come with a message. She had to go off to see her family."
Vimes felt the faintest prickles on the back of his neck. "Anyone know why?" he said.
"Dunno, sir. She left all her stuff."
"All right. Sergeant, before you go off shift, get someone to find her, and then go and get some sleep. The rest of you, go and get on with whatever it is you do. Ah, Mr. Drumknot." The patrician's personal clerk, who'd been watching Detritus's technique with a horrified expression, looked up at him.
"Yes, Commander?"
"What's this book? Is it his lordship's diary?"
Drumknot took the book.
"It looks like it, certainly."
"Have you been able to crack the code?"
"I didn't know it was in code, Commander."
"What, you've never looked at it?"
"Why should I, sir? It's not mine."
"You do know his last secretary tried to kill him?"
"Yes, sir. I ought to say, sir, that I have already been exhaustively interrogated by your men."
Drumknot opened the book and raised his eyebrows.
"What did they say?" said Vimes.
Drumknot looked up thoughtfully.
"Let me see now. It was you what done it, own up. Everybody seen you. We got lots of people say you done it. You done it all right. Didn't you? Own up. That was, I think, the general approach. And then I said it wasn't me, and that seemed to puzzle the officer concerned."
Drumknot delicately licked his fingers and turned a page. Vimes stared at him. The sound of saws was brisk on the morning air. Captain Carrot knocked against the timber yard door, which was eventually opened.
"Good morning, sir," he said. "I understand you have a golem here."
"Had," said the timber merchant.
"Oh dear, another one," said Angua.
That made four so far. The one in the foundry had knelt under a hammer. The one in the stonemason's yard was now 10 clay toes sticking out from under a 2-ton block of limestone. One working in the docks had last been seen in the river, striding towards the sea, and now this one.
"It was weird," said the merchant, thumping the golem's chest. "Sidney said it went on sawing all the way up to the moment it sawed its head right off. I've got a load of ash planking got to go out this afternoon. Who's going to saw it up, may I ask?"
Angua picked up the golem's head. Insofar as it had any expression at all, it was one of intense concentration.
"Here," said the merchant. "Alf told me he heard in the drum last night that golems have been murdering people."
"Inquiries are continuing," said Carrot. "Now then, Mr. It's Preble Skink, isn't it? Your brother runs the lamp oil shop in Cable Street, and your daughter is a maid at the university."
The man looked astonished, but Carrot knew everyone.
"Yeah. Did your golem leave the yard yesterday evening?"
"Well, early on. Something about a holy day."
He looked nervously from one to the other.
"You've got to let them go, otherwise the word's in their heads."
"And then it came back and worked all night?"
"Yeah, what else would it do? And then Alf came in on early turn, and he said it came up out of the saw pit, stood there for a moment, and then..."
"Was it sawing pine logs yesterday?" said Agua.
"That's right. Where am I going to get another golem at short notice, may I ask?"
"What's this?" said Angua. She picked up a wood-framed square from the heap of sawdust. "This was its slate, was it?" she handed it to Carrot.
"Thou shalt not kill," Carrot read slowly. "Clay of my clay ashamed. Do you have any idea why it had write that?"
"Search me," said Skink. "They're always doing dumb things."
He brightened up a bit. "Hey, perhaps it went potty. Get it? Clay? Pot? Potty?"
"Extremely funny," said Carrot gravely. "I will take this as evidence. Good morning."
"Why did you ask about pine logs?" he said to Angua as they stepped outside.
"I smelled the same pine resin in the cellar."
"Pine resin's just pine resin, isn't it?"
"No, not to me. That golem was in there."
"They all were," sighed Carrot, "and now they're committing suicide."
"You can't take life you haven't got," said Angua.
"What shall we call it, then? Destruction of property," said Carrot.
"Anyway, we can't ask them now."
He tapped the slate. "They've given us the answers," he said.
"Perhaps we can find out what the questions should have been."
"What do you mean, nothing?" said Vimes. "It's got to be the book. He licks his fingers to turn a page, and every day he gets a little dose of arsenic. Fiendishly clever."
"Sorry, sir," said Cheery, backing away. "I can't find a trace. I've used all the tests I know."
"You sure?"
"I could send it up to the Unseen University. They've built a new morphic resonator in the high-energy magic building. Magic would easily..."
"Don't do that," said Vimes. "We'll keep the wizards out of this. Damn, for half an hour there I really thought I'd got it."
He sat down at his desk. Something new was odd about the dwarf, but again he couldn't quite work out what it was.
"We're missing something here, Little Bottom," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"Let's look at the facts. If you want to poison someone slowly, you've either got to give them small doses all the time, or at least every day. We've covered everything the patrician does. It can't be the air in the room. You and I have been in there every day. It's not the food, we're pretty sure of that. Is something stinging him? Can you poison a wasp? What we need..."
"Excuse me, sir."
Vimes turned.
"Detritus, I thought you were off duty."
"I got them to give me the address of that maid called Easy, like you said," said Detritus stoically. "I went up there and there was people all looking in."
"What do you mean?"
"Neighbours and that, crying women all around the door, and I remember what you said about that diplo word."
"Diplomacy," said Vimes.
"Yeah, not shouting at people and that. I thought, this looks a delicate situation. Also, they was throwing stuff at me, so I come back here, I write down the address, and now I'm going home."
He saluted, rocked slightly from the force of the blow to the side of his head, and departed.
"Thanks, Detritus," said Vimes.
He looked at the paper written in the troll's big, round hand. "First floor, back 27 Cockbill Street," he said.
"Good grief!"
"You know it, sir?"
"Should do. I was born in that street," said Vimes. "It's down below the shades. Easy, easy. Yes, now I remember there was a Mrs. Easy down the road. Skinny woman, did a lot of sewing, big family. Well, we were all big families. It was the only way to keep warm."
He frowned at the paper. It wasn't as if it were any particular lead. Maidservants were always going off to see their mothers, every time there was the least little family upset. What was it his granny had used to say?
Your son, till he takes a wife, but your daughter's your daughter all her life."
Sending a watchman around would almost certainly be a waste of everyone's time.
"Well, well, Cockbill Street," he said.
He stared at the paper again.
"You might as well rename the place Memory Lane. No, you couldn't waste watch resources on a wild goose chase like that. But he might look in, on his way past. Sometime today." "Little Bottom?"
"Sir?"
"On your lips, sir. Red. On your lips."
"Lipstick, sir."
"Oh, lipstick. Fine. Lipstick."
"Constable Angua gave it to me, sir."
"That was kind of her," said Vimes. "I expect."
It was called the Rat's Chamber. In theory, this was because of the decoration. Some former resident of the palace had thought that a fresco of dancing rats would be a real decorative coup.
There was a pattern of rats woven in the carpet. On the ceiling, rats danced in a circle, their tails intertwining at the centre. After half an hour in that room, most people wanted a wash. Soon, then, there would be a big rush on the hot water. The room was filling up fast. By common consent, the chair was taken and amply filled by Mrs. Rosemary Palm, head of the Guild of Seamstresses, as they were euphemistically named. People said they call themselves seamstresses. Ahem, ahem. As one of the most senior guild leaders.
"Quiet, please, gentlemen."
The noise level subsided a little.
"Dr. Downey," she said.
The head of the Assassin's Guild nodded.
"My friends, I think we are all aware of the situation," he began.
"Yeah, so's your accountant," said a voice in the crowd.
There was a ripple of nervous laughter, but it didn't last long, because you don't laugh too loud at someone who knows exactly how much you're worth dead. Dr. Downey smiled.
"I can assure you once again, gentlemen and ladies, that I am aware of no engagement regarding Lord Vetinari. In any case, I cannot imagine that an assassin would use poison in this case. His lordship spent some time at the assassin's school. He knows the uses of caution. No doubt he will recover."
"And if he doesn't?" said Mrs. Palm.
"No one lives forever," said Dr. Downey, in the calm voice of a man who personally knew this to be true. "Then no doubt we'll get a new ruler." The room went very silent. The word "who" hovered silently above every head.
The thing is, said Gerhard Sock, head of the Butcher's Guild, "it's been, you've got to admit it, it's been, well, think about some of the others."
The words "Lord Snapcase" now, at least this one isn't actually insane, flickered in the group consciousness.
"I have to admit," said Mrs. Palm, "that under Vetinari it has certainly been safer to walk the streets."
"You should know, madam," said Mr. Sock. Mrs. Palm gave him an icy look. There were a few sniggers.
"I meant that a modest payment to the Thieves' Guild is all that is required for perfect safety," she finished.
"And indeed a man may visit a house of
negotiable hospitality," said Mrs. Palm quickly.
"Indeed, and be quite confident of not waking up stripped stark naked and beaten black and blue," said Sock.
"Unless his tastes run that way," said Mrs. Palm. "We aim to give satisfaction, very accurately if required."
"Life has certainly been more reliable under Vetinari," said Mr. Potts of the Baker's Guild.
"He does have all straight theatre players and mime artists thrown into Scorpion Pit," said Mr. Boggis of the Thieves' Guild.
"True, but let's not forget that he has his bad points too. The man is capricious."
"You think so? Compared to the ones we had before, he's as reliable as a rock."
"Snapcase was reliable," said Mr. Sock gloomily. "Remember when he made his horse a city councillor?
You've got to admit he wasn't a bad councillor, compared to some of the others.
As I recall, the others at the time were a vase of flowers, a heap of sand, and three people who had been beheaded."
"Remember all those fights? All the little gangs of thieves fighting all the time? It got so that there was hardly any energy left to actually steal things," said Mr. Boggis.
"Things are indeed more reliable now."
Silence descended again. That was it, wasn't it? Things were reliable now. Whatever else you said about old Vetinari, he made sure today was always followed by tomorrow. If you were murdered in your bed, at least, it would be by arrangement.
"Things were more exciting under Lord Snapcase," someone ventured.
"Yes, right up to the point when your head fell off."
"The trouble is," said Mr. Boggis, "that the job makes people mad. You take some chap who's no worse than any of us, and after a few months he's talking to moss and having people flayed alive."
"Vetinari isn't mad."
"Depends how you look at it. No one can be as sane as he is without being mad."
"I am only a weak woman," said Mrs. Palm, to the personal disbelief of several present. "But it does seem to me that there's an opportunity here. Either there's a long struggle to sort out a successor, or we sort it out now, yes?"
The guild leaders tried to look at one another while simultaneously avoiding everyone else's glances. Who'd be patrician now? Once there had been a huge multi-sided power struggle, but now... You got the power, but you got the problems too. Things had changed.
These days you had to negotiate and juggle with all the conflicting interests. No one sane had tried to kill Vetinari for years, because the world with him in it was just preferable to the one without him. Besides, Vetinari had tamed Ankh Morpork. He tamed it like a dog. He'd taken a minor scavenger among scavengers, and lengthened its teeth, and strengthened its jaws, and built up its muscles, and studded its collar, and fed it lean steak, and then he'd aimed it at the throat of the world. He'd taken all the gangs and squabbling groups, and made them see that a small slice of the cake on a regular basis was better by far than a bigger slice with a dagger in it. He'd made them see that it was better to take a small slice, but enlarge the cake. Ankh Morpork, alone of all the cities of the plains, had opened its gates to dwarfs and trolls. Alloys are stronger, Vetinari had said. It had worked. They made things. Often they made trouble, but mostly they made wealth. As a result, although Ankh Morpork still had many enemies, those enemies had to finance their armies with borrowed money. Most of it was borrowed from Ankh Morpork, at punitive interest. There hadn't been any really big wars for years. Ankh Morpork had made them unprofitable. Thousands of years ago, the old empire had enforced the Pax Morporcia, which had said to the world, "Do not fight, or we will kill you." The Pax had arisen again, but this time it said, "If you fight, we'll call in your mortgages. And incidentally, that's my pike you're pointing at me. I paid for that shield you're holding, and take my helmet off when you speak to me, you horrible little debtor." And now the whole machine, which whirred away so quietly that people had forgotten it was a machine at all, and thought that it was just the way the world worked, had given a lurch. The guild leaders examined their thoughts and decided that what they did not want was power. What they wanted was that tomorrow should be pretty much like today. "There's the dwarfs," said Mr. Boggis. "Even if one of us, not that I'm saying it would be one of us, of course, even if someone took over, what about the dwarfs? We get someone like Snapcase again, there's going to be chopped kneecaps in the streets."
"You're not suggesting we have some sort of vote, are you? Some sort of popularity contest?"
"Ah, no, it's just all more complicated now, and power goes to people's heads."
"And then other people's heads fall off."
"I wish you wouldn't keep on saying that, whoever you are," said Mrs. Palm. "Anyone would think you'd had your head cut off." "Huh? Oh, it's you, Mr. Slant. I do apologise."
"Speaking as the president of the Guild of Lawyers," said Mr. Slant, the most respected zombie in Ankh Morpork, "I must recommend stability in this matter. I wonder if I may offer some advice."
"How much will it cost us?" said Mr. Sock.
"Stability," said Mr. Slant, "equals monarchy."
"Oh, now, don't tell us."
"Look at Clatch," said Mr. Slant doggedly. "Generations of serifs. Result, political stability. Take Pseudopolis, or Stolat, or even the Agatian Empire."
"Come on," said Dr. Downey. "Everyone knows that kings..."
"Oh, monarchs come and go, they depose one another and so forth," said Mr. Slant. "But the institution goes on. Besides, I think you'll find that it is possible to work out an accommodation."
He realized that he had the floor. His fingers absent-mindedly touched the seam where his head had been sewn back on. All those years ago, Mr. Slant had refused to die until he had been paid for the disbursements in the matter of conducting his own defence.
"How do you mean?" said Mr. Potts.
"I accept that the question of resurrecting the Ankh Morpork succession has been raised several times recently," said Mr. Slant.
"Yes, by madmen," said Mr. Boggis. "It's part of the symptoms. Put underpants on head, talk to trees, drool, decide that Ankh Morpork needs a king."
"Exactly. Supposing sane men were to give it consideration."
"Go on," said Dr. Downey.
"There have been precedents," said Mr. Slant. "Monarchies who have found themselves bereft of a convenient monarch have obtained one, some suitably born member of some other royal line. After all, what is required is someone who, knows the ropes, as I believe the saying goes."
"Sorry, are you saying we send out for a king?" said Mr. Boggis. "We put up some kind of advertisement. Throne vacant, applicant must supply own crown."
"In fact," said Mr. Slant, ignoring this, "I recall that during the First Empire, Genua wrote to Ankh Morpork and asked to be sent one of our generals to be their king, their own royal lines having died out through interbreeding so intensively that the last king kept trying to breed with himself. The history books say that we sent our loyal general Tacticus, whose first act after obtaining the crown was to declare war on Ankh Morpork. Kings are interchangeable." "You mentioned something about reaching an accommodation," said Mr. Boggis. "You mean
We tell a king what to do.
I like the sound of that, said Mrs. Palm.
I like the echoes, said Dr. Downey.
Not tell, said Mr. Slant. We agree. Obviously, as king, he would concentrate on those things traditionally associated with kingship.
Waving, said Mr. Sock.
Being gracious, said Mrs. Palm.
Welcoming ambassadors from foreign countries, said Mr. Potts.
Shaking hands.
Cutting off heads?
No, 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 that will not be part of his duties. Minor affairs of state will be carried out
by his advisers, said Dr. Downey.
He leaned back. I'm sure I can see where this is going, Mr. Slant, he said, but kings once acquired are so damned hard to get rid of, acceptably.
There have been precedents for that, too, said Mr. Slant.
The assassin's eyes narrowed.
I'm intrigued, Mr. Slant, that as soon as the Lord Veterinari appears to be seriously ill, you pop up with suggestions like this. It sounds like a remarkable coincidence.
There is no mystery, I assure you. Destiny works its course. Surely many of you have heard the rumours that there is in this city someone with a bloodline traceable all the way back to the last royal family? Someone working in this very city in a comparatively humble position? A lowly watchman, in fact?
There were some nods, but not very definite ones. They were to nods what a grunt is to yes. The guilds all picked up information. No one wanted to reveal how much or how little they personally knew, just in case they knew too little, or even worse, turned out to know too much. However, Doc Pseudopolis of the Guild of Gamblers put on a careful poker face and said,
"Yes, but the tricentennial is coming up, and in a few years it'll be the century of the rat. There's something about centuries that gives people a kind of fever."
"Nevertheless, the person exists," said Mr. Slant. "The evidence stares one in the face if one looks in the right places." "Very well," said Mr. Bogus. "Tell us the name of this captain."
He often lost large sums at poker.
"Captain," said Mr. Slant. "I'm sorry to say his natural talents have thus far not commended him to that extent. He is a corporal. Corporal C.W. St. J. Nobbs."
There was a silence. And then there was a strange putt-putting sound, like water negotiating its way through a partially blocked pipe. Queen Molly of the Beggars' Guild had so far been silent, apart from occasional damp sucking noises, as she tried to dislodge a particle of her lunch from the things which, because they were still in her mouth, and apparently attached, were technically her teeth. Now she was laughing. The hairs wobbled on every wart.
"Nobby Nobbs," she said. "You're talking about Nobby Nobbs?"
"He is the last known descendant of the Earl of Ankh, who could trace his descent all the way to a distant cousin to the last king," said Mr. Slant. "It's the talk of the city."
"A picture forms in my mind," said Dr. Downey. "Small, monkey-like chap, always smoking very short cigarettes. Spotty. He squeezes them in public."
"That's Nobby," Queen Molly chuckled. "Face like a blind carpenter's thumb."
"Him? But the man's a tit."
"And dim as a penny candle," said Mr. Bogus. "I don't see—"
Suddenly he stopped, and then contracted the contemplative silence that was gradually affecting everyone else around the table.
"Don't see why we shouldn't give this due consideration," he said after a while.
The assembled leaders looked at the table. Then they looked at the ceiling. Then they studiously avoided one another's glance.
"Blood will out," said Mr. Carey.
"When I've watched him go down the street, I've always thought, there's a man who walks in greatness," said Mrs. Palm.
"He squeezes them in a very regal way, mind you. Very graciously."
The silence rolled over the assembly again, but it was busy in the same way that the silence of an anthill is busy.
"I must remind you, ladies and gentlemen, that poor Lord Veterinari is still alive," said Mrs. Palm.
"Indeed, indeed," said Mr. Slant. "And long may he remain so. I've merely set out for you one option against that day, may it be a long time coming, when we should consider a successor."
"In any case," said Dr. Downey, "there is no doubt that Veterinari has been overdoing it. If he survives, which is greatly to be hoped, of course, I feel we should require him to step down for the sake of his health. Well done, thou good and faithful servant, and so on. Buy him a nice house in the country somewhere, give him a pension, make sure there's a seat for him at official dinners. Obviously, if he can be so easily poisoned, now he should welcome the release from the chains of office."
"'What about the wizards?' said Mr. Boggis.
"'They've never got involved in civic concerns,' said Dr. Downey. "'Give 'em 4 meat meals a day, and tip your hat to them, and they're happy. "'They know nothing about politics.'
The silence that followed was broken by the voice of Queen Molly of the Beggars.
"'What about Vimes?'
Dr. Downey shrugged.
"'He is a servant of the city.
"'That's what I mean.
"'Surely we represent the city.'
"'He won't see it that way. "'And you know what Vimes thinks about kings? "'It was a Vimes who chopped the head off the last one. "'There's a bloodline that thinks a swing of an axe can solve anything.'
"'Now, Molly, you know Vimes had probably taken axe to Vetinari "'if he thought he could get away with it. "'No love lost there, I fancy.'
"'He won't like it, that's all I tell you. "'Vetinari keeps Vimes wound up. "'No knowing what happens if he unwinds all at once.'
"'He's a public servant,' snapped Dr. Downey. "'Queen Molly made a face which was not difficult in one so naturally well-endowed, "'and sat back.
"'So this is the new way of things, is it?' she muttered. "'Lot of ordinary men sit around a table and talk, "'and suddenly the world's a different place.' The sheep turn round and charge the shepherd.
"'There's a soiree at Lady Silach's house this evening,' said Dr. Downey, ignoring her. "'I believe Nobbs is being invited. Perhaps we can meet him.'
Vimes told himself he was really going to inspect the progress on the new watch-house in Chitling Street. Cockbill Street was just around the corner, and then he'd call in, informally. No sense in sparing a man when they were pushed anyway, what with those murders and Vetinari and Detritus's anti-slab crusade. He turned the corner and stopped. Nothing much had changed, that was the shocking thing. After, too many years, things had no right not to have changed. But washing lines still crisscrossed the street between the grey ancient buildings. Antique paint still peeled in the way cheap paint peeled, when it had been painted on wood too old and rotten to take paint. Cockpill Street people were usually too penniless to afford decent paint, but always far too proud to use whitewash. And the place was slightly smaller than he remembered, that was all. When had he last come down here? He couldn't remember. It was beyond the shades, and up until quite recently the watch had tended to leave that area to its own unspeakable devices. Unlike the shades, though, Cockbill Street was clean, with the haunting empty cleanliness you get when people can't afford to waste dirt. For Cockbill Street was where people lived who were worse than poor, because they didn't know how poor they were. If you asked them, they would probably say something like, "Mustn't grumble," or "There's far worse off than us," or "We've always kept us heads above water and we don't owe nobody nowt." He could hear his granny speaking, "No one's too poor to buy soap." Of course, many people were, but in Cockbill Street they bought soap just the same. The table might not have any food on it, but by gods it was well scrubbed. That was Cockbill Street, where what you mainly ate was your pride. What a mess the world was in, Vimes reflected. Constable Visit had told him the meek would inherit it, and what had the poor devils done to deserve that? Cockbill Street people would stand aside to let the meek through. For what kept them in Cockbill Street, mentally and physically, was their vague comprehension that there were rules. And they went through life filled with a quiet, distracted dread that they weren't quite obeying them. People said that there was one law for the rich and one law for the poor, but it wasn't true. There was no law for those who made the law, and no law for the incorrigibly lawless. All the laws and rules were for those people stupid enough to think like Cockbill Street people. It was oddly quiet. Normally there'd be swarms of kids and carts heading down towards the docks, but today the place had a shut-in look. In the middle of the road was a chalked hopscotch path. Vimes felt his knees go weak. It was still here. When had he last seen it? 35 years ago? 40? So it must have been drawn and redrawn thousands of times. He'd been pretty good at it. Of course, they'd played it by Ankh-Morpork rules. Instead of kicking a stone, they'd kicked William Scuggins. It had been just one of the many inventive games they'd played which had involved kicking, chasing, or jumping on William Scuggins until he threw one of his famous wobblers and started frothing and violently attacking himself. Vimes had been able to drop William in the square of his choice 9 times out of 10,
The 10th time, William bit his leg. In those days, tormenting William and finding enough to eat had made for a simple, straightforward life. There weren't so many questions you didn't know the answers to, except maybe how to stop your leg festering. Sir Samuel looked around, saw the silent street, and flicked a stone out of the gutter with his foot. Then he booted it surreptitiously along the squares, adjusted his cloak, and hopped and jumped his way up. Turned, hopped. What was it you shouted as you hopped? Salt, mustard, vinegar, and pepper? No. Or was it the one that went, William Scuggins is a bastard? Now he'd wonder about that all day. A door opened across the street. Vimes froze, one leg in mid-air, as two black-clothed figures came out slowly and awkwardly. This was because they were carrying a coffin. The natural solemnity of the occasion was diminished by their having to squeeze around it and out into the street, pulling the casket after them, and allowing two other pairs of bearers to edge their way into the daylight. Vimes remembered himself in time to lower his other foot, and then remembered even more of himself and snatched his helmet off in respect. Another coffin emerged. It was a lot smaller. It needed only two people to carry it, and that was really one too many. As mourners trooped out behind them, Vimes fumbled in a pocket for the scrap of paper detritus had given him. The scene was in its way funny, like the bit in a circus where the coach stops and a dozen clowns get out of it. Apartment houses round here made up for their limited number of rooms by having a large number of people occupy them. He found the paper and unfolded it. First floor, back, 27 Cockfield Street. And this was it. He'd arrived in time for a funeral. Two funerals.